Hello, and welcome to this podcast from our Edinburgh friends, Scott. Edinburgh is our passion, and one that we enjoy sharing with over 4 million visitors every year. Every visitor has their own reasons for coming, and our aim is to ensure that your visit is special to you. An experience built around you and your interests. Please visit our website, where you'll find information, resources and contacts to help you make your visit to Scotland's capital special for you. The subject of this podcast is Waverley Railway Station, the principal station in the city and the arrival point for many visitors. There are pictures on our website that you can browse through as you listen. For convenience and ease of downloading, this podcast is in two parts, and you're listening to part one. Let us start with something that makes Waverley Station unique. It is the only railway station in the world to be named after a work of fiction, Waverley, published by Walter Scott in 1814. The people of Edinburgh are quietly proud of this fact. Indeed, when the old Caledonian station at the west end of Princes Street closed in 1966, British Rail decided that they could now drop the name Waverley, and the station was renamed simply Edinburgh. However, local feelings were outraged, and a petition started. British Rail quickly realised they'd made a mistake, and the name Waverley reappeared on signage and in the timetable. Arriving at Waverley, two things strike the traveller almost at once. The first is, to borrow the title of an old song, "The only way is up." Waverley Station is built at the lowest point in the city centre, so you have to go up to go out. Once upon a time, for most travellers, this meant a long slog up the great stone staircase of the famous Waverley Steps. Today there are lifts and escalators at all points, making life a great deal easier. The second has already been mentioned. Waverley is right in the city centre. Unlike, say, King's Cross or Paddington in London, travellers leaving Waverley are at once pitched right into the beating heart of the city. However, before we look at Waverley today, we really should step back a little in time. 12,000 years should do.
At that time, the whole of Scotland was covered in glaciers and thick sheets of ice. These gouged at the land, cutting deep valleys either side of the hard volcanic stone of Castle Rock. It is in that valley to the north of the castle that Waverley is now situated. In the Middle Ages, this was a landscape of marshes and shallow pools through which ran a small river, little more than a stream really, known locally as the Tummel. In 1460, King James III had ordered that this stream be dammed in order to flood the valley, creating a better defensive position. The body of water thus formed became known as the Norloch. The Norloch was probably never very deep, and because it was pretty much stagnant, it was never suitable as a source of drinking water. In fact, it rapidly became the city's dumping ground, with all manner of refuse and ordure thrown into it. What water did flow came out through a dam at the eastern end of the loch. Here, away from the castle and the high street, with its narrow closes and huddled tenement buildings, the land must have been a little sweeter. For it was here, on land that is now under the eastern end of Waverley Station, that on the 5th day of March, in the year of our Lord, 1462, Mary, Queen of Scotland, widow of James II, and mother of the boy King James III, founded the Collegiate Church of the Holy Trinity. This Mary should not be confused with the later Mary, Queen of Scots. She would not be born for another 80 years. This Mary was the daughter of the Count of Geldres in the modern-day Netherlands and was, by all accounts, a strong and intelligent woman. When her husband was killed by a cannon bursting at a siege in the Scottish borders, she took an active role in guiding her young son through the intrigues of the Scottish court. Sadly, she died only a year after the foundation of Holy Trinity, leaving the 11-year-old King James III to the tender mercies of others. His reign would not be remembered as outstanding. Queen Mary was buried in an ornate tomb in the Lady Chapel of the church that she had founded. The style of the church would later be called Decorated Gothic. Accounts of the place often remark on the many grotesque gargoyles and crouching monsters there seemed to be about the place, holding up the pillars and walls. There was a hospital attached to the church, though this was not the kind of hospital we think of today when that word is mentioned. This was more of an old people's home with extra care and prayers. The principal way that residents would pay for their upkeep was by attending services 3 or 4 times a day and offering up prayers to the Lord for the immortal souls of their benefactors. Any medical care would have been rudimentary and much of it based on plant or herbal remedies. Perhaps it was this tradition that, some 300 years later, would attract 2 pioneering doctors to relocate their physic garden to land belonging to the hospital.
Dr. Robert Sibbald and Dr. Andrew Balfour were both physicians and plant collectors. They wanted to study plants that had supposed medicinal properties, understand them, and also teach others. They started at a site in the grounds of Holyrood Palace, but soon outgrew this, and in 1676 moved to Trinity Hospital. In later years, the garden would again move to other locations in the city, before finally settling at Inverleith, where they formed the core of what is now the Edinburgh Botanical Gardens. These are open to the public and are well worth a visit. There's more information on our website. The site of the 1676 garden is roughly where Platform 11 sits today. And for the next 100 years, that's pretty much how the area that is today's Waverley Station remained. Valley, loch, church and garden would all have been visible to Charles Edward Stuart, or Bonnie Prince Charlie as he was known to some, when he arrived at the head of his Highland army in September 1745 and entered the city by the Netherbow port. His hopes and the Jacobite cause would fall less than a year later on the field of Culloden. In the peace that followed, a new, enlightened and modern Edinburgh would rise. In the years after Culloden, the population of Edinburgh grew as never before. By 1760, it was bursting at the seams and needed to expand beyond the old town. Centuries of rubbish dumping had turned the Norlock into a stinking, noxious lake, and it was decided the best course was to drain it and bridge the valley with a crossing next to the Physic Garden. This would become the North Bridge. Work started in 1763 and took 5 years to complete. Unfortunately, in August 1769, part of the bridge collapsed after the heavy rain washed away ground below the bridge footings. Heavy rain in August? Modern festival goers will recognise that. The bridge was repaired and reopened in 1772. Some of the building costs were recouped by renting out the vaults below the bridge as market space or storage areas. One arch was kept by the city for its own use. Beggars found on the street were imprisoned there on a bread and water diet until they decided they no longer wished to take advantage of Edinburgh's hospitality.
With the growing city came a need for fuel. There was coal in abundance at nearby collieries, so the only question was the most efficient and economic way to get it into the city. In 1814, Robert Stevenson, engineer to the commissioners of Northern Lighthouses, and grandfather of the author Robert Louis Stevenson, considered the problem and presented his findings. He proposed digging a canal into the city, running through the Norlock to a basin at the far end by North Bridge. Interestingly, he mentions in his plans the use of railroads, short stretches of track where wagons, pulled by horses, would bring the coal from the pit head or workings to the canal. This idea had some backers, but Stevenson also met opposition. He suggested that the canal could be extended from North Bridge all the way out to Leith Harbour, raising the intriguing possibility of ships coming all the way into the city centre. However, this plan involved bisecting a well-loved golf course, and thus was clearly a step too far. The proposal was not taken up. Before moving on, it is worth noting that canals did come into Edinburgh, but only as far as the western edge of the city. One basin still exists at Locrin and can be visited. Just a few years later, in 1824, a group of local businessmen met in an Edinburgh cafe to look once more at the original problem. The city was expanding at a greater rate than ever before. The cost of fuel continued to rise, and all manner of domestic, commercial, and industrial properties were crying out for the affordable coal that lay in such abundance nearby, yet arrived in dribs and drabs by means of expensive and uncertain horse carts. This time, someone suggested a railway might be constructed. As luck would have it, there was a local man on hand with just the right set of skills. Thomas Granger was engineer and surveyor to the Monkland and Kirkintilloch Railway. He went into partnership with John Miller from Ayr, a mathematics graduate with an interest in the new technology of steam. Together, they drew up a scheme for a line that would run from Leith and Edinburgh to Glasgow. It was ambitious and far-sighted. This was only 10 years on from the world's first steam railway between Stockton and Darlington in England. And perhaps this was its downfall. Parliament in London rejected it. Granger and Miller were undaunted. Taking some of the work they had already done, they proposed a more modest scheme. This would be a line from Edinburgh to the port at Newhaven on the Firth of Forth, with a branch running to Leith Docks. The Edinburgh end of the line would be south of Prince's Street and east of North Bridge, at the site identified by Stevenson for a canal basin. Despite the fact that this involved the radical step of tunnelling below the new town, Parliament was more agreeable to this proposal, and on the 13th of August 1836 it granted permission to go ahead. The first step towards what would one day be Edinburgh Waverley had been taken.
Granger and Miller went back to Parliament with further submissions for the Edinburgh to Glasgow line, and at the third attempt they were successful. In 1838 they started work on linking the two cities. However, though they wished to join the Edinburgh and Glasgow Railways line to the Edinburgh, Leith and Newhaven Railway, Parliament specified that the route must terminate at Haymarket. The line took only 4 years to build and was an instant success, despite third-class passengers having to travel in open trucks, whatever the weather. Taking the line further would involve cutting through Prince's Street Gardens, and the residents of that most desirable street had successfully petitioned Parliament to prevent any commercial undertakings that would spoil their enjoyment of the gardens or the view of the castle. The residents were led by a High Court judge, Lord Henry Cockburn, who said,
"The whole beautiful ground will be given up to railways and their yards, depots, counting houses and other abominations."
Whatever Lord Cockburn's objections might have been, he was swimming against the tide of history. There was a new young queen on the throne and a sense of optimism in the air. The Industrial Revolution was delivering new technologies and bringing a surplus of funds into Britain. Investors were looking for somewhere to put this extra cash, and railways seemed the perfect mix of low risk and high return. The success of the Edinburgh and Glasgow Railway had made people sit up and notice. The newspapers told almost daily of the progress of the lines that were snaking north from London. It seemed clear that whichever company was there to meet them would surely make a killing. It was into this atmosphere that one hot summer's day in 1842, the North British Railway Company was born.
The North British, as we shall refer to it from now on, saw the possibilities in a line running east from Edinburgh to Dunbar and thence round the coast to Berwick, or Berwick-upon-Tweed as the railways would name it, to save confusion with another town of the same name in the south of England. In 1844, the North British took for their station a piece of land that had previously been used as part of a larger vegetable market sheltering under the old North Bridge. As a consequence, they named this first station North Bridge. It opened for business 2 years later, on the 18th of June 1846, when a train of 50 carriages pulled by 9 locomotives took a select band of the great and the good, and of course shareholders, on a round trip to Berwick. The second part of what would become today's Waverley Station was now in place. Incidentally, for those of you wondering why it was called the North British Railway Company rather than, say, the Scottish Railway Company, there's an explanation and further reading on the Waverley page of our website. Meanwhile, the Edinburgh and Glasgow Railway had not been idle. While the North British was busy constructing its east coastline, the Edinburgh and Glasgow had finally been given the right to make a cutting through Princes Street Gardens to the city centre. This agreement had not been reached without some compromises. Locomotives running through the gardens had to be fired by coke, the closest thing that Victorian engineers had to a smokeless fuel. Trains also had to proceed slowly, and, most crucially, they were not allowed to put up any building or construction more than 30 feet above the running line. In effect, the railway was to be invisible from the drawing room windows of the residents on Princes Street. The new Edinburgh and Glasgow terminus was a little to the west of the North British station, just alongside a spot that is marked on the 1846 Ordnance Survey map as Waverley Bridge, possibly because it ran south from Princes Street, close to a point where building work on the Scott Monument had begun in 1841. The station was named Waverley Bridge, but locals soon started to refer to it as just Waverley. At which point, you might think that the final part of the jigsaw is now in place. However, that's not quite true.
You'll recall that the Edinburgh, Leith and Newhaven Railway Company had chosen the site of the canal basin, and now called Canal Street, though the canal was never built, as their terminus. However, they had run into problems. First, the Duke of Buccleuch, one of Scotland's richest men and a principal backer of the scheme, had decided to develop a harbour on his land at Granton, necessitating a change to the line and the company name. Secondly, they had run into geological problems and resident opposition regarding the tunnel under the new town. Their trains would continue to terminate at Scotland Street, 1,000 metres to the north, until the final link was opened in May 1847. Finally, Edinburgh had three railway stations within walking distance of each other. There was Northbridge, whose lines stretched away to the east, Waverley Bridge, with tracks running west to Glasgow, and Canal Street, with rails running at 90 degrees to the others, away north through the Scotland Street Tunnel under the new town. Now, a modern business person might question why these three companies did not share facilities. This would surely have been to both the convenience of passengers and some cost savings to the companies. In fact, the Edinburgh and Glasgow had approached the North British with just such a proposal, but it was turned down. These Victorian entrepreneurs seem to have had a keen sense of independence.
Almost at once, the North British began to outgrow the modest station at Northbridge. It needed to expand. The area where it could do this was obvious. The problem was, the space was occupied by the medieval Trinity Church. What followed was to become a familiar theme in Edinburgh, and one that continues to this day: preserving the past versus moving with the times. Leading the opposition to the railway was, once again, the formidable Lord Cockburn. He eloquently pointed out that Trinity was the oldest and most complete Gothic structure in the city, a building of great architectural merit and the one-time resting place of a Queen of Scotland. The city fathers, owners of the church since the Reformation, were acutely aware of the prosperity that the railway was bringing to the city. They sought a compromise. The church would be dismantled and re-erected elsewhere in the city. The railway would have their ground. Lord Cockburn was appalled. He called it
an outrage by sordid traders, virtually consented to by a tasteless city and sanctioned by an insensible parliament.
The city received £20,000 from the North British to pay for the dismantling, numbering and rebuilding of Trinity Church. However, the stones were stored for many years on Calton Hill, and when it was proposed that they be incorporated into a new church on Cockburn Street in 1872, it was discovered that many had gone missing, while others were too damaged to be reused. A fragment was later erected and may be seen today at Chalmers Close, off the Royal Mile. At the time of recording, in early 2018, it is not open to the public, but on the outside you can still see some of those ancient gargoyles and, if you look carefully, the numbers on some of the stones.
The 1850s were a boom time for railways. It was now possible to get from Edinburgh to London in just 12 hours, an astonishing improvement when one considers that just a generation earlier it would take 10 days by stagecoach. Just as important was the trade in goods. An observer sat on Calton Hill for an hour any market day in the 1850s would have seen the arrival of hundreds of wagons laden with coal. There would be trains bringing in fish from the north, newspapers and mail from the south and west, and thousands of sheep and cattle arriving to be shipped to the markets of England. Everywhere was a bustle of activity. The railway continued to grow. It took in more land, first covering the space where the Physic Garden had been, and then some poor housing in an area known as Low Calton. Many railway families lived in these buildings, so the North British decided to put up some new tenements in the city at Pleasance. These were one or two room dwellings with shared lavatories and only 8 bathrooms for the 828 people living there. That puts our ensuite bathrooms into some perspective. Despite this, there was still not enough room. There were now so many passenger trains using the stations that travellers arriving to catch a train would find the platform still crowded by the people and luggage from a recent arrival. Tempers were frayed, trains were missed, and fights broke out. Giving evidence to Parliament in 1860, our old friend, the engineer John Miller, said that he considered North Bridge Station to be positively dangerous. Something had to be done. The North British began to look closely at its neighbours.
Over at Canal Street, things had not been going quite as well. The Edinburgh, Leith and Granton Railway had been taken over by the Edinburgh and Northern Railway in 1849. That in turn had become the Edinburgh, Perth and Dundee Railway. This company operated ferries across the Firth of Forth, but the time and expense of transferring goods from railway wagons to the ferries and then back into wagons was making this an unprofitable business. In an effort to reduce costs, it came up with a scheme where laden trucks could be placed onto the ferry using a special railed ramp and offloaded back onto the tracks by the same method on the other side. In effect, they had created the world's first roll-on, roll-off ferry. Management, however, was not good, and the company was losing money. The North British saw their chance. In 1862, they took over the Edinburgh, Perth and Dundee. The North British now proposed a new line to Leith and Granton via Abbey Hill. This would be a little longer, but overall more convenient, and it would run eastward from North Bridge, thus removing the need to use the Scotland Street Tunnel. It would also free up the space taken by the then redundant Canal Street Station. At the same time, the North British also reached an agreement with the North Eastern Railway in England, allowing them to run trains to Newcastle over North Eastern lines, while in return, North Eastern trains could run to Edinburgh on the North British track. This saved passengers having to change at Berwick and speeded up the express service. That Victorian sense of individualism was having to bend a little in the service of pragmatism. Finally, in 1865, the North British amalgamated with the Edinburgh and Glasgow Railway. This was not a takeover, for the Edinburgh and Glasgow had always been a profitable line. Though one company was much larger than the other, this was a meeting of equals and they had to learn to work together. This was no doubt helped by the fact that the engineers in chief of both companies had been trained by John Miller. They were now one company. It was time they came, quite literally, under one roof.
That concludes part one of the history of Edinburgh Waverley from ouredinburghfriends.scot. You can download part two from our website. If you'd like to learn more about Edinburgh, or you'd like us to help you with planning a visit, just go to our website, ouredinburghfriends.scot. Lang may your lum reek.